small stage.
I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than have answers which might be wrong.
It's not really about going to another star system. It's about how do we improve life here on Earth.
Not only the question, but the way you try to solve it.
Beauty at this dimension, one symphony, is also beauty at a smaller dimension.
Hello and welcome to Sharing Science Radio. We're broadcasting from CITR 101.9 FM on unceded Musqueam territory at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. We're blazing up some science today. Here you're going to hear about how science is done, who's doing it, what it's telling us, and why it matters to you. I'm your host, Alan Manning, and with me today is Sam Livingston.
Hi, guys.
And Angela Cho.
Hello.
Today, pass the mic to the left-hand side. That's right. This show is all about the science of cannabis. This plant, originally from Southeast Asia, has spread all over the world into some of our lungs and into the labs of science. With the legalization of cannabis in four U.S. states, more dispensaries in Vancouver than Starbucks, and a new government in Ottawa, the question of the safety and the medicinal uses of cannabis are demanding answers, and science is providing some of them. So today on Sharing Science, we're going to tell you about some of this research. Angela is going to dive into the effects of using marijuana, and I'll be talking about how marijuana screws with your mind molecularly. And Sam is going to get high-tech with cannabis biotech. So lay back, relax, and let your ears inhale the science.
All right, so here's the big debate, the pros and cons of marijuana use. Archaeological evidence shows that the earliest medical uses of cannabis originate in China around 2000 BC. The plant was used to treat menstrual fatigue, constipation, gout, amongst other sicknesses, and was also used as anesthetic for surgical operations. Currently in North America, prescribed marijuana is widely used to treat physical discomfort. In some users, it decreases the effects of mental complications and certain diseases like glaucoma. In addition, a study done at the California Pacific Medical Center showed that the chemical CBD found in cannabis may help prevent cancer or at least slow it down by turning off a gene called ID1, which regulates the spread of cancer cells. While all of that sounds great, it's time to analyze the opposition. In several studies, they evaluated how chronic marijuana users performed tasks when abstinent for 6 weeks to 2 years and found significant impairment in selective attention and concentration. In a separate study, it was shown that with at least 12 hours of abstinence, chronic marijuana users had significantly impaired decision-making skills and had greater risk-taking tendencies. It seems that after 3 weeks of abstinence, basic attentional and working memory abilities are largely restored. However, the most detectable defects are seen in decision-making, concept formation, and planning. And just to be safe, ladies, if you plan to have children or are expecting, it would probably be best to stay away from marijuana. While the relationship between cannabis use and complications in pregnancy are less clear, due to cannabis users often being users of other substances, such as alcohol and tobacco, a few studies have shown possible correlations between cannabis use and decreased birth weight, which is related to inhibited growth and development in babies.
By the 1900s, we knew what nicotine was and how to synthesize it. We knew how to make it in a lab without using tobacco. We knew what morphine was. We were using that. We knew how to refine cocaine. But precisely what it was in the cannabis plant that got people high was unknown. It took until 1964 before the answer was found. Tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC. Now that was great and everything, because everyone likes to know what a thing is and what it's named, but scientists have also got to know how it works. So the brain is a noisy place with all its neurons chattering away, but it's not noisy with sound, it's noisy with chemicals. Neurons use special chemicals called neurotransmitters to communicate. And psychoactive drugs, in one way or another, affect this communication. I like to imagine the brain as some kind of large, horrendous bureaucracy. The workers in each cubicle are kind of like the neurons. Information is being transferred within the company from person to person by emails, phone calls, or conversation, and these different ways of communicating are like the different neurotransmitters in the brain. So what happens when this person, this brain bureaucracy is running, decides to do a line of coke? Well, cocaine basically makes it so that all the people in the office start running around and talking to each other, and they don't shut up. In the human brain, cocaine causes a flood of the dopamine neurotransmitter. This is because in the human brain, cocaine causes a flood of the dopamine neurotransmitter. As another example, in the bureaucracy, alcohol makes a lot of people just stop talking to each other. That's because it acts as a sedative. So what the heck does THC do? Well, people could not figure it out for a long time. And it wasn't until 1988 that some of the puzzles were answered. In 1988, Alan Howlett and her colleagues at the St. Louis University attached a radioactive tag to the THC molecule and watched where it went exactly in rats' brains. And what they found was that it attached itself to the outside of nerve cells. But it was still unknown what exactly it was doing. Some people thought that perhaps it was disrupting the membrane of these nerve cells in a weird way, in a way that no other drug acted. But then in 1992, the problem was solved. It had turned out that there was actually a specific receptor in the membrane of each nerve cell that the THC molecule connected to. For each neurotransmitter, there is a receptor. And it turned out that there was actually a receptor for the THC molecule, which was kind of weird. Why would there be a receptor in the human body for a chemical from a plant? And people looked into this in more detail. And it actually turned out that the body produced chemicals that were very similar to the THC molecule, and that these chemicals were what the body's own receptors were looking out for. And they discovered that there's this whole system, it's now known as the endocannabinoid system, inside the body. And this consists of molecules called endocannabinoids that are produced by the body and endocannabinoid receptors. And these are like a funky kind of neurotransmitter, this whole new type of neurotransmitter that no one even knew existed. Endocannabinoid receptors are found all throughout the brain and the spinal cord. But you would find an increased concentration in areas like the cerebellum that are associated with movement and the hippocampus, which are associated with memory. The fact that this receptor is found throughout the brain is the reason why cannabis has such an intricate and complicated effect on the body. And it also opens the door for many new therapies based on this endocannabinoid system. This new knowledge has been generated by answering the question of how marijuana actually gets you high could lead to new therapies in cancer, MS, obesity. These are therapies that all could act through this new endocannabinoid system. So it's great that all those hippies in the 1960s actually drove science forward. And Sam is here to talk a little bit about how cannabis is used in biotechnology.
Cannabis is a topic that, up until the last decade or two, has been very taboo to openly discuss in a public setting. Due to strict governmental regulations on the growth and use of cannabis in the last century, research on the plant has been shoved into a closet where only few researchers on both the botanical and medical sides have had a chance to really dig into the nature of the products that have given the plant its taboo nature, namely the cannabinoids. THC and its alter ego CBD are the most commonly known and researched cannabinoids. THC, for its prowess in inducing mind-altering effects and potential for therapeutics, and CBD, for its high quantities in hemp, but also with lots of potential for therapeutics. Interestingly, some research has found that CBD actually blocks the effect THC has on the brain to a certain extent, and breeders of hemp and marijuana strains of cannabis have tried to keep the two separate as much as possible. It's quite widely known at this point that marijuana has a very potent effect on the human body and mind when ingested, and the majority of attention the public has on cannabis is focused on its use by humans. But let's pause for a second and think about the plant that produces these cannabinoids day in and day out until it gets plucked out of the ground and has the vast majority of its material discarded that is unusable for recreational and medical purposes. THC and CBD are the two predominant cannabinoids produced by rather small-looking structures, commonly referred to as hairs, called glandular trichomes, and they're found densely covering the flowers of cannabis. It's in these trichomes where the magic happens. In a complex but recently completed biosynthetic pathway, researchers now have a strong understanding of the identity for each of the many biological enzymes that takes two really common chemicals made by both plants and animals and turns it into THC, CBD, or the other 102 known cannabinoids. That's right, it's not just THC or CBD that's found in cannabis, but a whole whack of highly under-researched chemicals. Now that we know each of the steps in biosynthesis, many with interest in the field are calling for researchers to start producing THC and CBD in bacteria or yeast for the production of cannabinoids that have less unwanted plant compounds or undesired cannabinoids to make pure medicines. In fact, researchers from Stanford have done something similar in August of this year with opium compounds, being able to completely synthesize a very complicated multi-step biosynthetic pathway for producing pain-killing opiates in yeast inside a test tube. Cannabinoid biotechnology has yet to reach the same level, despite multiple recent reports of a group who recreated only the last step of the process to produce THC in bacteria, had popular science media outlets reporting complete biosynthetic synthesis of the entire pathway. However, sometimes the last step of the process is really just the first.
Thanks for that, Sam. We're going to take a quick break. Stick around for some more Sharing Science Radio on CITR.
Hardcore 2015, this Saturday, November 7th. Come on down to the Rickshaw Theater for the greatest night of punk rock Vancouver has seen in years. Canadian punk rock legends DOA and Gob join forces for the first time ever. Your world will be changed and your sorry complacent will be kicked. They will also be joined by the Boyds from Montreal and the sensational Wet Stilettos. Join the fun before DOA takes a hiatus as Joe Keithley works on becoming BC's next premier. Visit www.ticketfly.com for tickets.
Welcome back to Sharing Science Radio on CITR. Today we're talking about the science of cannabis. Before the break, we heard a story from Angela about some of the medical effects of cannabis. Sam told us about the biotechnology of cannabis, and I talked about how it works on a molecular level. So right now we're going to geek out and dive into these stories in a little bit more detail. Sam, you were talking a lot about biosynthetic pathways, and we are a jargon-free zone, so maybe we should just explain precisely what a biosynthetic pathway is.
I like the jargon-free zone. That's a good description of what this is supposed to be. So a biosynthetic pathway is if you start with beginning materials and you want to get to a new type of material, you need to go through a set of intermediates that are facilitated by other molecules. So if we start with molecule 1, we need enzyme 1 to turn molecule 1 into molecule 2. Sometimes biosynthetic pathways can be up to like 100 enzymes or 100 different molecules that all act together. So when we think about molecule 1 turning into 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and all the way to its final finished product, that is the biosynthetic pathway that happens in any living organism.
Okay, so it's how, like, the Big Mac gets turned into your hair and your skin.
Yeah, exactly. Or how the lettuce and the beef and the buns turn into a Big Mac.
Because I don't think a Big Mac's going to really help your hair.
Well, okay, maybe it's how it turns into the fat. It's stored inside your body.
Definitely.
There you go.
It's good at doing that.
Yeah. All right, now, is there a difference between cannabis, marijuana, and hemp?
Yes, absolutely. So there's a couple different definitions that you might be looking at when you're trying to differentiate between cannabis, marijuana, and hemp. So cannabis, when we talk about that, that is just the plant itself. Its specific species name is called Cannabis sativa. So then now when we talk further and we want to discuss whether it's a recreational or a medical user of cannabis or whether it's being used in textiles or paper or seed oil when we talk about hemp. So the difference there is marijuana is being used by humans in a recreational or a medical facility, whereas hemp is more used for industry and other resource-based facilities.
Like making a rope. I mean, like for thousands of years, well, hundreds of years, ropes were made from hemp.
Because it was one of the strongest biopolymers that were made. Yep.
Very interesting.
The other definition that we can use, and this is the legal term for marijuana and hemp, is a cannabis sativa plant, if it is producing more than 0.3% THC, which is one of the psychoactive cannabinoids that gets the user high. If it's higher than 0.3%, then it's considered marijuana. If it's less than 0.3%, then it's considered hemp.
I heard this story, and it was just about a farmer who's farmed hemp and said it was very difficult because all the time people break in and try and steal his plants because obviously it looks like marijuana.
To the untrained eye, it's probably looking the exact same.
Now, have you guys seen The Martian?
I haven't, no.
Well, yes. Luckily for us, Sam Livingston is the best botanist on the planet in this recording studio.
Thanks for that clarification.
Yeah. Now, okay, so we've got this plant that produces THC and other cannabinoids. As you said, there's 102 other of them. And I talked a little bit about how these mimic endocannabinoids produced by your body. But why does the plant even produce these chemicals at all? Like, what's the purpose of it? Now, nicotine comes from the tobacco plant, and it's known to be an insecticide. That's the purpose of that chemical in that specific plant. But what are the cannabinoids, what role are they playing in the marijuana or the cannabis plant?
That's a great question, Alan, because that's something that has been asked for a long time. And in terms of the research that's been done on it, there are very few ecological studies that have actually looked at the role of, say, THC or CBD or really any of those oils that are produced by cannabis and their role in the plants. There's speculation that it's about the plant's defense mechanisms against pathogens, which could include bacteria that are trying to eat its way into the cannabis plant for nutrients. Maybe it's insects who are biting off portions of the leaf, or maybe it's even mammals who are coming by and grazing and trying to just chop up everything that's around. So this cannabis plant, which is actually one of the best plants at producing these oily compounds, there's a bunch of different plants that produce oily compounds in order to defend itself, but one of them is that THC and CBD can be very toxic, just like nicotine can be. So certain research articles have proposed that it could be an insecticide, though robust studies haven't shown that. But one of the other speculations is that since it is so sticky, as soon as a small insect lands on a leaf and it breaks one of the trichomes that holds a bunch of the oil, it immediately gets stuck. It's like warm tar or newly poured cement that as soon as the legs step onto it, it's not going anywhere and the insect is going to die right away.
Probably has a good death, though.
So it's funny that you bring up that it might have had a good death. So what Alan is trying to say is that maybe that insect got a little bit high before it died. But that's actually not true, because even though we have an endocannabinoid system that allows us to exploit and use marijuana for its therapeutic or its recreational purposes.
As a side effect,
of course. Any animal that you can think of, and that goes down to the sea sponges that exist in the ocean, they all have a cannabinoid type of receptor. So we all have some origin that's the same over hundreds of millions of years that we still have an endocannabinoid system. But what's interesting is that somewhere down the line, insects lost the ability to recognize cannabinoids in their nervous system. So they no longer are able to recognize that there are cannabinoids in the system. So maybe it's losing its ability, or maybe it functionally lost the ability to recognize it in order to get ahead of the plant in that defense or that arms race of trying to kill each other.
Oh, so that maybe the cannabinoids were an insecticide, but then insects lost this receptor, so they were no longer affected by it. But now that the insecticide doesn't work, now it's just being used as sort of a sticky resin to trap the insects.
Yeah, because insects aren't cannabis's only problem, because there's a lot of different types of pathogens or things that it needs to worry about. So cannabinoids might still be very good at killing bacteria or yeast or any of the other animals that might be eating it, but there are still those other properties, like it being so sticky, that still can kill insects while still being a very effective bactericide or yeasticide, or other words that I'm just adding side to.
Interesting. So that's really cool. So the jury's still out on what exactly these were used for.
Yeah, and that's the same with all other plants that actually produce those oils as well, because there's not very many ecological studies that go along with that, and especially with cannabis, because some of the problems with research on cannabis is that it just hasn't gotten enough attention over the last, like, century or so because of the prohibition in North America and the outright illegalization in other parts of the world as well, and in general, it was just neglected for a very long time.
Well, that's probably changing now. Okay, so let's move on to the health stuff now. Now, Angela, you presented a story that was looking at some of the positive and negative aspects of the use of marijuana. Is the jury still out on whether marijuana is good for you or is marijuana terrible for you?
I would say that that is still to be determined. There are just so many people that think that marijuana is just bad for you. You know, it's just, it's causing all these neurological, psychological defects. I wouldn't say that that's completely true. There might be, like I said in my research, there might be certain side effects from chronic usage. However, there are benefits. And as we were told earlier by Sam, we're still researching pathways and there's still so much research to be done on it. I would say there are many years.
It seems a lot like the context of whether marijuana is good for the individual or not is totally context dependent. Like, are you asking for, is mm-hmm. it good for you to take marijuana for anti-nausea or something? Like, it seems like you could have a yes or a no, just totally dependent on...
Is it good to smoke it? Is it good to eat it?
Exactly.
Would that depend on the cannabinoid levels within the person?
It definitely could, yeah. If you think about the endocannabinoid system that Alan introduced, if all of our bodies are producing endocannabinoids at a certain level, and say that's the normal level of functioning... If a normal person who's producing normal levels of cannabinoids all of a sudden gets high off of marijuana and smokes a bunch of cannabinoids, they all of a sudden have an elevated number of cannabinoids in their mm-hmm. system. And that is disrupting the balance that's in your body, in your nervous system, in your digestive system. Really, your entire body is going to be affected by mm-hmm. it. But if you think of somebody who has, say, a genetic disorder or some other environmental disorder that causes them to produce less cannabinoids, then maybe the introduction of more cannabinoids from either marijuana or from some other – there are a few other plants that actually produce cannabinoids, but not THC, which is mm. just a side note. But if cannabinoids come from an outside source into your body, then maybe that brings you up to normal functioning levels. So it's not always true that marijuana could be bad for you. It's just totally context dependent.
It's interesting what you said earlier, Angela, about how there are some people out there who are really pro-marijuana and they'll grab onto any bit of evidence, anecdotal or scientific, and use it to say that, you know, marijuana cures everything from toenail fungus to the common cold. And then on the other side of the coin, there are people out there mm-hmm. who will grab onto any bit of evidence, anecdotal or scientific, and use that to say that marijuana is the devil, you know, something straight out of Reefer Madness. And obviously, like we're saying here, the truth is somewhere in between, depends on the person, depends on the environmental conditions, environmental factors, what specifically we're talking about. And basically, more research just needs to be done here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a very, very gray area.
One of the things that I remember from high school, and this is in BC, is that we never really touched upon the... mental effects of marijuana use, specifically in youth. And I think that's something that I'm not sure if it's done now, but there have been a lot of studies that show that the marijuana use in youth can lead to psychotic episodes or schizophrenia to people who are genetically predisposed to it.
Yeah, and it's good that you added that last clause in there, because it's not just an association between cannabis and psychosis itself. It's for people who have genetic markers that that predispose themselves to these other conditions as well. So there seems to be what's called a comorbidity of schizophrenic people and those who use cannabis. There seems to be more people who are schizophrenic and use cannabis than what you would expect for people who don't have schizophrenia and use cannabis.
Yeah, so I don't know if that's, like I said, I don't know if that's in the curriculum now, but I think obviously with dispensaries going up in Vancouver and, like we said, legalization in 4 U.S. states, I think it's something that we're going to have to start educating everybody on.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah, I can only say this anecdotally, but from the people that I've talked to in the field, I don't think any medical professionals would agree that cannabis use is good for anybody that's under 25. Unless it's something that they absolutely need in order to reach the age of 25. So I remember there's one girl that was down in, I think it was Colorado or Utah, where she had extremely severe epilepsy, where she would have multiple episodes, sometimes in the hundreds per day. And this is like a 2 or 3 year old girl, I think. Mm-hmm. And only under the treatment of CBD that she was able to reduce the severity of the epilepsy down to, I think it was like 2 or 3 episodes per day, something that was actually manageable for a 3 or 4 year old. And that's a one-off occurrence that you would normally see, like a 2 or 3 year old getting prescribed medicinal marijuana. But it's something that their parents had to fight very, very hard for.
Interesting. I think that's what's known in the biz as anecdotal evidence.
Anecdotal, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah. Still compelling. Still very compelling.
Absolutely. There are cases where it's absolutely needed, and then there are just millions of other cases where it's absolutely not needed, but people seem to think that it is.
Okay, well, that was a bit of a serious note. Why don't we finish on something kind of fun? Sam, I think you have a study that you are very fond of with regards to marijuana. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, there's this one last thing I want to mention before we go. So back in February, there was an article that came out that was making headlines in popular science media, and it said in big, bold letters across every single Facebook post, and my Facebook wall was totally flooded by it. Marijuana is 114 times safer than alcohol. Now, I would like everybody who's listening now to please do not use that as a soundbite, because I think that is one of the most ridiculous claims I've ever heard. Because what are the authors claiming it's safer by? Is it safer in a social context? Is it safer for your brain development? Is it safer for the risks that you take during the day? And again, coming back to what we were talking about, Angela, was that it's totally context dependent. So in this study, in case everybody just listened or everybody saw the title and then skipped and just wanted to share it after that, what I'd like to say was that the authors looked at the regular use by an individual. So say the average use by a person was 5 beers per night. And for marijuana, it was 1 joint per night. Then they compared that number to what the median lethal dose, meaning that how much it took to kill 50% of their animal subjects. Now, I think you've probably also seen this in the media where marijuana has one of the lowest potencies for killing mammals. So when what they're saying here is that the difference between the therapeutic use, so the 5 beers per night or the 1 joint per night, is 114 times greater than the killing dose of marijuana and alcohol. So how often are you ever going to reach those levels for alcohol? And it surely happens because you see accounts of people overdosing from alcohol and dying from it. But to get to that lethal dose of marijuana, you would have to continuously be smoking the marijuana cigarette constantly. You would have to have one that is Snoop Dogg style for the rest of your life. You would die from carbon monoxide poisoning before you would die from the cannabis itself.
I'm imagining in science fiction movies, you know, you have the aliens who have to breathe a different atmosphere and they wear like a body suit.
Exactly.
Imagine one of those just filled with smoke all the time.
I'm all the time.
Imagining one of those trifecta joints from Pineapple Express.
The cross joint. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So just take the BuzzFeed articles with a grain of salt, and all you have to do is look at what the authors were studying and how they arrived at those conclusions, because that's extremely important before you start sharing that 114 times safer.
Yeah, just read the methods, yo.
Read the methods. Don't you know what gas chromatography is?
So that's interesting, Sam. I also think that's just terrible. I mean, safer. What the heck does safer mean? Like you said, like it totally means like nothing. It's like saying that Canada is the greatest country in the world. Like, what does greatest mean?
You're saying it's not, though.
Well, can you quantify greatest?
Like, is it happiness?
Is it happiness?
Economy?
Is it like
Olympic gold medal in hockey?
Yeah, exactly. Do we have like the nicest feet? Do we have the most maple syrup? Like, what does that mean, greatest? It's like saying our product is 50 times better than the other product.
Yeah.
Get rid of these weasel words. Better, greatest, safest. Like, that means absolutely nothing.
It's propaganda. And it's propaganda from both sides. Because you see that marijuana is the gateway drug and it's going to kill everybody as soon as someone touches it. But then you see the other side where it's 114 times safer, so everybody smoke up.
Really glad you mentioned the article, because I know so many friends that have come up to me and told me this specific statistic. And I would ask them, okay, well, why? And they have no idea why, because they didn't read the article.
Yep. It's really just a case of, do you want to know, or are you happy with what you're told?
One of these days we're going to do a show on cognitive biases, and it's amazing because it's just basically how humans are illogical and not very smart and how you trick yourself every day.
I think it's coming up pretty soon, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it should be coming up pretty soon. All right, well, we should wrap this up. Today, you've been hearing about the science of cannabis on Sharing Science Radio. With me today was Sam Livingston.
Thanks for stopping in.
And Angela Cho.
Thank you.
If you'd like to comment on anything you heard about today or suggest future topics for the show, you can reach us at the following email address, radio@ubcsharingscience.org. That's radio@ubcsharingscience.org. We would love to hear from you. Today's show was edited by Sam Livingston. The music was provided by Wes Pride, and it was recorded here at CITR. Stay tuned. Up next is Sam Squanch's Hideaway. See you guys next week.